I hope I get a bike for my birthday. I hope Billy asks me to the dance. I hope the baby's a girl. Every day, all over the world, people are saying things that sound something like this. Merriam-Webster says that to hope is to cherish a desire with anticipation. And dictionary.com says it's the feeling that what is wanted can be had, or that events will just turn out for the best. I would say to you that if faith is that which you dare to believe can be true, hope goes right with it. Hope is the anticipation that it will be true. So let me repeat that. If faith is that which you dare to believe can be true, hope is the anticipation that it will be true. Hope and faith feed one another. They can't exist without one another, but where do we find hope? Bill Schultz, the past president of the UUA, and a lovely man who I had the great fortune to have teach several of my courses in seminary, asked a group of us seminarians that question a few years ago. And of course, being Bill, what he actually said was, if I were to go, as I have so many times, to sit with those who have been tortured, who have seen the worst humanity has to offer, what source of hope could I give to them? In a world filled with despair, tell me why I should get up tomorrow morning. Why should they get up tomorrow morning? And don't be idiotic in your answer. Now, you talk about perspective. You're a first-year seminarian sitting there hearing this, and that trite little answer you were about to give that copied word for word from the book you read last night, and you're about to give it to a man who has traveled the world with Amnesty International, with the UUA, who has stood with the victims of torture and held them as they cried, and you're going to give him a smart-aleck answer. Ooh, no. This was a real question, a question where that trite answer would do more harm than good. And to answer the question, we have to look first at how we learn to hope. A baby doesn't hope. When we're born, we don't hope. We have no concept of anticipation. Have you ever played peekaboo with a little bitty kid? When you or they cover their eyes, the world disappears. It is over. Their eyes are uncovered, and what sorcery is this? The planet has come back into existence. It's a miracle. They laugh and they clap and they want to do it over, and each time it's the same miracle. But as the baby grows, the idea of desire, of want, starts to take root. And of course, a toddler's desire is about 9 seconds long, because that's as long as they can remember. They see mom or dad or older sibling with cookies. They want the cookies. They start to dance around with one hand out, anticipating the cookies they get every afternoon. They develop faith in the presence of cookies. And if their faith is rewarded long enough, eventually they begin to hope for more cookies, for better cookies, for cookies like the ones they saw on TV or at the store. They no longer just want something, no longer just dare to believe it will be there. They want something joyfully, with a real anticipation of getting it. If that child's hope of cookies is supported, if mom or dad or parent or guardian continues to buy cookies, and sometimes they're the really good ones, the child learns that hope is real, that it is reasonable and worthwhile. Simple lesson. But what happens when something goes wrong? When either the cookies stop before the child dares to believe that they will be there, and so there is no faith, or the child develops faith that there will be cookies, and then they stop. Hope fails. But in a world where cynicism seems to be everywhere, where bad things do exist and violence can be overwhelming, we can keep hope from failing. We can keep the metaphorical cookies coming. We affirm and promote seven principles: the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth, a free and reasonable search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of democratic process, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice, and respect for the interdependent web of all existence. For many of us, our own faith, what we dare to believe can be true in the world, arises from these principles. We ask ourselves questions about the nature of the ultimate, the nature of humanity, about life and death, right relations, community. And when we find what we believe, we not only believe it, we believe it because we feel that it can happen. This isn't just some pipe dream. We believe and we cherish our anticipation and hope for the realization of our vision of reality. Without faith, without that daring to believe that something can be true, there's no hope. They are intimately connected. And our faith, our hope, can bring hope to those who have none. One of my favorite stories of the creation of hope is the story of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a U.S. civil rights activist who led the fight against segregation and other forms of racism as a minister in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Cincinnati, Ohio. And Reverend Shuttlesworth was one of the people who helped pave the way for MLK. He was the co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and was instrumental in the 1963 Birmingham campaign. He worked against racism and for alleviation of the problems of the homeless in Birmingham and in Cincinnati, Ohio, when he moved there in 1961. He helped Dr. King during the Civil Rights Movement and was given an acceptance award to visit him at any time during the movement. What did Reverend Shuttlesworth do? He brought hope that it would actually be possible to live in a better world. Hope of surviving, of thriving together. Hope not just on a distant God, but on one another. In May of 1956, Shuttlesworth and Ed Gardner established the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights to begin to take over where the NAACP formerly had worked. They were determined to fight through education and protest and litigation to end racism. And perhaps for the very first time, both black and white people believed it was real. It could be done. Knowing that on December 26th of 1956, the group would begin to challenge racism laws, someone decided that they would stop Reverend Shuttlesworth. They taped 16 sticks of dynamite under his window on the night of December 12th. The house blew up. People were already gathering to mourn when Reverend Shuttlesworth walked out of the rubble unharmed. Of course, he ran directly into the police officer who had been sent to see what happened, a member of the local Klan. He advised the Reverend, "If I were you, I'd just get out of town as quick as I could." Shuttlesworth told him to tell the clan that he wasn't leaving and that he hadn't been saved to learn to run. He held in his hands at that moment the hope of his community, not only faith that he could succeed, but true hope that the whole work would be successful. In 57, Shuttlesworth, along with Dr. King and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Joseph Lowry, Reverend T.J. Jamison from Baton Rouge, K.C. Steele from Tallahassee, Reverend A.L. Davis from New Orleans, Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker, founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It adopted a motto to underscore its commitment to nonviolence: not one hair of one head of one person shall be harmed. He embraced that philosophy, even though his own personality was combative, headstrong, and blunt-spoken, to the point that he antagonized, well, pretty much everyone. He was not shy in talking to Dr. King, who he felt should take a more active role, and warned him that history would not look kindly on those who gave flowery speeches but did not act. Eventually, by devoting as much time to the civil rights movement as to his own church, he alienated his congregation. In 1961, Shuttlesworth moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and to the Revelation Baptist Church. He returned to Birmingham over and over. He was personally fearless. When other activists were scared off or mystified by him, he said he had vowed to kill segregation or to allow it to kill him. For those who heard him speak, who saw him walk away from beating after beating, it was a revelation. Someone worked for them. Someone cared. Someone had faith in a world that could be different. And his faith, one man's faith, was often enough to create hope where it had never been before. And the beautiful thing about this hope, and any hope, is that it's self-reinforcing. Each day as we struggle to live by our values and principles, to call into being those things we dare to believe can be true, we are driven to hope. And as we hope, we work harder to make these hopes come true. Hope is not created by a divine agency or given to people as some specific gift. It is the work of human hands and human hearts, part of the silk which makes up the interdependent web. Like faith, it is active. It ebbs and flows. It can be given as a gift to one another. It underlies all that we attempt to achieve. It can falter and fail, but it can never be destroyed. On March 19, 2006, I was honored to be at the Greater New Light Baptist Church to hear Reverend Shuttlesworth preach his final sermon before he retired. I had met him many times before, always impressed by how quickly he could aggravate an entire room into doing something that he felt needed to be done. He was a little stooped and had to be helped onto the stage that day, but resplendent in a pale pink shirt and glowing pink pocket square. The applause went on forever, and men and women began to cry as the music began. After saying that, well, he never was as good at religion as he could be, he gave a sermon about the amazing use of the human mind. Quoting scripture liberally, he reminded his audience, "You can't just unscrew a human head and put a better idea in there. It don't work like that." He talked about becoming part of a great communal mind headed by Jesus and his understanding that would work toward betterment for all. He talked and talked about the call to go forward bravely, despite dynamite or brass knuckles or chains, living in hope that you had done right and would bring healing to the world. Self-reinforcing hope. And it didn't hurt that he reminded his flock several times that he was indeed, as he said, dynamite proof, here to show you. What an incredible man. My last story about hope is one that I have been intimately familiar with, and some of you may have similar stories. A little over 4 years ago, I'd made a decision to change my life, to follow my faith wherever it would lead me, and to go into ministry. I applied to seminary and was accepted, and I felt great. Took a job at a little tiny nursing home, working 2 16-hour shifts a week as a nurse, and I prepared to go to my first classes. For the first time in years, I had to buy pencils. But something weird was going on. I had lost 80 pounds over the previous year and was feeling a little strange. I attended the first convocation at seminary, began my reading list, but the strange feeling had gotten worse. One day as I was typing, I realized my fingers weren't hitting the right keys, and my entire page was gibberish. My vision started to fluctuate, and I realized that week at work that I couldn't see the pills or the markings on the needles. I tried to read my own charting as a nurse, and it was scribbles on the page. There were no words. I went home terrified, rejoicing that I had 5 days until I had to be back there, unsure of what was happening. A few days later, I went to a new local doctor and asked for lab tests, but it was too late. I woke up the next morning and I didn't know my middle name or my birthday or where I was. My arms and legs jerked and seized and my head rolled in circles. Voices told me I was going to die and that I should run away as we drove frantically for the hospital. At the ER, I managed to tell a nurse I was having some kind of psychotic episode for all I knew. And then I sat and started to cry. Tests revealed that my thyroid hormones had become toxic and my brain had swollen in response, a condition called Hashimoto's encephalopathy, also known as pseudo-Alzheimer's disorder. If we couldn't find a way to reduce the swelling and stop the thyroid, I would suffer from progressive dementia and would typically die within 36 months. I couldn't even understand what they were telling me. But a week later, I was introduced to my doctor, my endocrinologist, the man who would come to save my life. He sat with me in an appointment room for over an hour and a half as I tried to understand what he was telling me. And at last he said, "All right, here's your job. Stop worrying. Start hoping. I will get you through this." Well, I thought he was a big fat liar. I underwent medication, then radiation and burns, eventual thyroid removal. And when I woke up from the surgery, I had a shock. My laryngeal nerves had been partially severed, my left vocal cord paralyzed, my parathyroids removed. I could not speak. I could not process calcium. And I would have to be on multiple medications for the rest of my life. I couldn't breathe because my paralyzed vocal cord blocked my throat. After training as a vocalist from the time I was 9 years old, I was told I will never sing again. I wouldn't be capable of being a nurse for months or years. More than one person told me that perhaps ministry was no longer appropriate. But each time I met with Dr. Pretorius, he had a new trick, a new approach, something new to try. And my faith in him grew, and as it did, my hope. At my teaching church, my first year of seminary, I was unable to speak. I spent a year listening, reading, doing assignments in silence. First one surgery, then another to create a working, possible vocal cord. 3 more surgeries to cope with the side effects of the medications. I lost part of my nose, part of the muscle in my upper left leg. The meds destroyed first my right red blood cells and then my hair. And I sat at church in chemo caps, writing things down so that people could understand what I thought. I did a pastoral residency at Good Sam Hospital. It took me over an hour to walk the eighth of a mile from my car to my floor. The muscles and tendons in my legs wouldn't work. More meds were needed, and Dr. Pretorius told me to shut up and keep hoping, because he hadn't lost faith. 27 months ago, I woke up after the seventh surgery and found that my left vocal cord was corrected. My voice had come back deep and rougher, but it was there. A few med changes later, and my hair began to grow. And then my brain stopped swelling, and the effects receded. Last January in Chicago, I sang in front of an audience for the first time since I had gotten ill. The swelling in my brain is gone. I can walk without pain. Bill Schultz asked a serious question that day. In a world filled with despair, tell me why I should get up tomorrow, why those who have suffered should get up tomorrow, and I have an answer. You should get up because human hands, powered by belief in a better world and working every day to be a source of hope, can create miracles for themselves and for the world. How do you give hope to the hopeless? As my doctor did, as Reverend Shuttlesworth did, you dare to believe in a world where your vision is the right one, where failure is not an option, and where hope will never end. Amen.